Welcome to Old Elton John's La Liga Weekly, thanks to our new Patreons. We did a Patreon free-to-air special on Friday, reviewing everything that had happened in La Liga in midweek. And now, basically, you should forget everything that we said, because all the teams that were good then are now bad. So Betis were flaky and Valencia ground out a result. Forget that, we're back to the new normal of Valencia being rubbish. Nobody in the world is happier about empty football grounds than Valencia's owners. Go on, sell Condogbia, like you say, what's anyone going to do about it? In midweek, we celebrated with rock-solid streetwise Getafe, who were top. Yeah, well, they lost 3-0 to Real Sociedad, leaving Jose Bordalas moaning about his opponents being spoilers, a bit like the kettle moaning about the pot for having unfeasibly shiny black hair. Now, everything has changed, however. Real Madrid sweated out another win, top of the league, and for the 84th time since we've been podcasting, I will ask Terry the following question. Should Casemiro have got a second yellow? Atletico drew 0-0 again, and we still haven't seen Suarez and Costa together. There were two goalless draws in La Liga this weekend. It's the lack of goals and the inconsistent performances down to the exceptional circumstances. No idea, because in the Premier League they've gone back to 1934 and every game finishes 5-3. In fact, here's my stat of the weekend. Three Spanish goalkeepers played in the Premier League and conceded between them 17 goals, which is exactly the same number of goals that were scored in the whole of the weekend in La Liga. It's a crazy world, but we'd still like you to listen as we attempt to make sense of it and pay us for the privilege. Patreon.com/LTEL. $5 or £4.50 in good old English money is the British money is the cheapest option, which Shane Hurley did not take. He is a Ronaldinho. And when you're that good, you're not a luxury. So thank you very much to everybody who has joined in the Patreons. We'll be doing special Patreon stuff, but we are still here. We still will be talking to everybody. And of course, we will be watching La Liga and trying to make some sense of it, Terry. So, I suppose it's exceptional circumstances means weird stuff happens. And it doesn't necessarily follow some kind of pattern because in La Liga, there aren't many goals. I commentated a championship game at the weekend. There are less than two goals per game in the championship. And yet in the Premier League, it's crazy. And it's not all down to handball penalties and dodgy penalties. It's so much of it is down to straightforward bad defending. But I think the lack of crowds creates a weird atmosphere and weird stuff is happening.
It must do. You know, I haven't been to any of the games, obviously, with the behind closed doors. And it would be interesting to see how the players view it now because it's become normal. You know, at the start, when it first happened, I remember watching the first games from Germany. It was, this is weird. And then obviously other countries then started following suit. And we've had the fake crowd noise. And we've got the computer-generated supporters in the stadium in the Spanish game. But you kind of lose track of what the players are going through in terms of what it's doing to them mentally. So, like, at the weekend, let's take the Premier League, for instance. I know we're a La Liga podcast, but when you go behind 3, 4, 5 goals, if a crowd are there, then you do feel that certain urgency, I guess, to avoid embarrassing yourself, avoid your team in embarrassment in front of their own supporters or in front of a crowd of people. When it's empty, it'd be interesting to know how the players view it, that you don't have that.
Yeah, because I think... this is weirdly sort of rewriting history, and I didn't really want to offer it up to Barcelona at the time, but I think the 8-2 against Bayern Munich wouldn't have happened with supporters in the ground. Now, I know there were lots of issues with Barcelona at the time, but they did give up a bit like you give up in a kickabout. When you're 5-0 down in a kickabout in the park, you stop bothering. And I think there is an element of that. And I don't think, for example, the Liverpool, they wouldn't have conceded 7 with a crowd in there. Barcelona wouldn't have conceded 8 against Bayern Munich.
And Manchester United definitely would have conceded 6 against Spurs. No, and the same would apply there. I think there is an element of, you're being embarrassed and you want to try and avoid conceding you want to concede the least goals possible, even if you're getting beat, if there's 40,000, 20,000, 60,000 people in the stadium. You kind of forget that you're on television as well, whenever you're playing football. For the majority of time, the crowd is even in the background. You know, you're out on the pitch, you're doing your stuff. You kind of forget the crowd are there until something happens or until you need their support. If you're chasing a last-minute winner or an equaliser, then you feel the atmosphere that the crowd generates. But by and large, you're in your own sort of zone. But to take that away completely, it'd be really interesting to know. I hope the players are not getting used to it. That's what, you know, I fear, that the players are kind of getting used to it. But then, of course, when the supporters do come back, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be everything. It really does make a huge difference to what we're watching on television, to the players that are playing out there. But at the moment, it's just become the norm that, you know, we hear that fake crowd noise. But some games you don't get it, and you just hear out. It's kind of eerie, isn't it? You know, you can hear the managers, and you can hear players shouting. You can hear the managers arguing with each other, which is quite good fun, which we don't normally get to hear. But it is fascinating, I think, to see. We're interested going into it, weren't we? Into the play without any supporters there, to see whether home advantage would count. Don't know the statistics, but I would imagine some teams suffer more than others.
It doesn't count for a lot, not nearly as much. Again, because I had to work it out, I worked it out for the championship again at the weekend, and it's almost literally gone entirely. And it probably varies from league to league, but overall, yeah, it turns out the crowd. Who knew? You know, it turns out having thousands of people there watching and reacting has a big effect on the game.
Yeah, and it's just a weird period that we're all going through, and some clubs will suffer more than others. You know, there's some clubs that their supporters really do play a big part. You know, it might be a team that's struggling at the bottom that supporters get behind them every game. It might be a team going, you know, for the title or promotion. So the supporters of certain clubs do really play a massive part. So I can't wait for the supporters to be back in the stadiums. But I take your point. I think these weird scorelines that we're getting back to the Barcelona Bayern Munich game, the couple of games in the weekend in the Premier League. But we in Spain, we clearly haven't got that issue at the moment in terms of ridiculous scorelines.
No. If anything, I think the greatest tactical play in La Liga maybe is keeping the scoreline down, in that, you know, lots of Premier League games are pretty wide open, for good and for bad. You know, there are teams who should play wide open. You know, we saw Bielsa's Leeds the other day against Guardiola's Man City. That was fun. But other teams, not so good. And you know, anyway, shall we get on to the meat of the games as well?
Still see, because what we spoke about in the podcast in recent weeks, I still see a massive difference in the styles of the Premier League and La Liga. And I purposely looked out for it during the last couple of weeks, because I spoke about playing out the back. And the teams in La Liga playing out the back, almost like an obligation, is minimal.
Yeah.
They do it at the right time. So we don't get as many of those goals conceded where, you know, teams are playing out the back. They're playing a ridiculous high line, some of the teams in the Premier League as well. It's almost, as I said, it's an obligation, it's a fashion, it's a trend. And the games in the Premier League look very different to what we see in La Liga.
Every Premier League team now plays like a Paco Hemeth team. We used to the mick out of Paco Jiménez, didn't we? You know, and love it and appreciate it. But the games were,
and they got relegated, conceded goals.
Yes, that was the thing, wasn't it? But he became a cult figure and still is. But like you said, I think there is a little bit more pragmatism in La Liga.
Yeah, which teams playing offside in their own half in the Premier League?
How
ludicrous is that? This high line is like, it's people are obsessed with it. The high temp, the high press, the high defensive line playing out the back. I mean, the goal Manchester United conceded against Spurs yesterday, when they went down to 10 men, immediately played a short goal kick. I think it was Bailly played it into Matic on the edge of his own penalty area, intercepted within two passes, quick passes, great passes by Spurs. Harry Kane's rattling it into an empty net. That is just stupid to do that. You know, game management is almost like an obsession with coaches to make their teams play out of the back under any circumstances. The only way you can play a high press against a team is if you know they're going to play out the back. Then that's an invitation, an open invitation. So if you're playing against someone who are going to do whatever they can to play out the back, you can squeeze up, you can go and close down, you can put players in the attacking half, in the final third, go man to man, because you know that they've got no plan B. So that's anyway, if you're playing against Atletico Madrid and they make no attempt to do those ridiculous goal kicks, since that goal kick rule came out, it's not obligatory that you have to play it in your own penalty area. You can't squeeze up against Atletico Madrid. There's no point.
Mm.
Because they're going to... Oblak will throw it out quickly if it's on. He'll play a short pass to a player if it's on. But they're not looking there, standing there. Everyone's static. Five against five around the edge of the penalty area, thinking, I've got to play this into a player. I'm going to play him into trouble. Then, all right, I'll chip it to the fullback. There's nothing worse than waiting for a hanging ball in the air, knowing you're going to get absolutely clobbered by a player who's attacking it on the run. So I've been looking in the last couple of weeks since I spoke about that on the podcast, the differences in La Liga and the Premier League. And when I see the Premier League games and I saw the defending yesterday, a lot of it stems from ridiculously playing out the back. In La Liga, they play it out the back when it's on. When it's not on, they tend to do what's necessary. So I think that's the big difference between the two leagues. Yet, ironically, the topic over the years has been, is he physical enough to play in the Premier League? And I still get that. I still get asked that question. And people are baffled and they don't believe a word I say when I say that a lot of teams in La Liga, and we'll go through the games this weekend, a lot of teams in La Liga play a 4-4-2. They play pretty direct. They've learned if you haven't got the budgets and whatever, there's a way of playing football that they can make them competitive. And that's what we're seeing in La Liga now. Not every team in La Liga plays the same, thankfully. And I think that's what makes it such an interesting league.
However, Levante are a bit guilty of it, aren't they? Of knocking the ball around at the back, getting caught in possession quite a lot. But sometimes it works. It was a exciting game against Real Madrid. But they lost 2-0 because Real Madrid do what they do. They found a way of scoring some goals. Vinicius got one. Benzema in the 95th minute got one. And Real Madrid. Now, is this unfair? Real Madrid's player of the season, Courtois?
Yes, followed closely by Modric.
Yeah.
And there's already calls in the press for Real Madrid to, I think it's well publicised that everybody thinks it's going to be Modric's last season. But the form that he's showing, he is the leader of the team. And at the age of 35, you can fully understand why the press, the media in Spain are suggesting that why wouldn't you give him another year? He was fantastic, Courtois. The main reason that Real Madrid won that game was because Courtois was in incredible form again. And he's really turned his career around at Real Madrid. But, it takes all sorts to keeping clean sheets and to keep winning games by an odd goal in this case. The second goal from Benzema in the 95th minute was the last kick of the game. And you need your defence to play well. You need people like Nacho to come in, who's third choice right back. You need Ramos to be there every week. You need the pace of Varane to get you out of trouble when you need to. Not every game is easy for Real Madrid. Far from the case. And I'm talking about a competitive La Liga. Teams are organised. They know how to compete. So you need all those elements. Ferland Mondi, a little bit worried about him. I think he's trying to proved that he can be as good attacking as Marcelo. And occasionally he's getting caught out of position where he's upfield and can't get back. So I think they need just to tidy up that little bit. But, if you've got a solid defence and you're keeping clean sheets, some games you need your goalkeeper to have a weldy, and that's what Courtois did. One save from a deflection is fantastic. I mean, he's gone for the shot. He's dived full length to his left. He gets a massive deflection, goes to his right, and while he's laying on the floor, he just sticks out a leg and kicks it clear. I mean, it was unorthodox, but instinctive. He's playing absolutely brilliant. So some weeks they need him to be the reason they keep a clean sheet, but they keep doing it. They sweated it out again. As I said, it was 1-0 to the 95th minute. Levante were doing everything they could to get the equaliser. And it wouldn't have been an injustice if Levante had got a draw. But Real Madrid kept a clean sheet and Real Madrid get another 3 points. So, fair play to them. If they're not playing well, but they are winning games, they're scoring sufficient goals, they're keeping clean sheets, and I'm sure Zidane will be hoping that in time their form will improve. But over the years, I've said about this little period, I know it's a different time of the year, but when the season starts, between international breaks, there's one before the season starts, there's one now. If you can avoid any slip-ups and you've got through this little period, which has been, it's been hectic, it's been bedlam, and Real Madrid have pretty much done that. They come through unscathed and managed to keep getting 3 points.
Casemiro, should he have had a second yellow card? I think it's short answer.
Yeah, of course he should. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's when you see some of the cards. I mean, Ruben Duarte got booked twice yesterday in a minute for Alaves. None of them, neither of those were as bad as Casemiro's. Yeah. I mean, we can talk about Longley's two bookings last week for Barcelona. The second one, it's a yellow card all day long. It's the classic yellow card offence. It's a tackle when you go to ground slightly from behind through the player. It was Gonzalo Malero, and he looked astonished that the referee didn't show the yellow card. So, yep, no, he should have done.
On balance, though, because Ramos had a goal ruled out, didn't he, for offside? And they drew the lines on, and I can't see him offside. And when they've drawn the lines on,
I was really confused with that little episode because, in my opinion, I didn't think he was offside, but I thought it was a push. So I thought they were looking at the push.
Yeah, but he gave offside, though, didn't he? Because he raised his hand for the indirect free kick. So, yeah.
So I think eventually they got the right decision with the wrong call. Yeah. Which, because I thought it was a push. There was a clear arm in the back of the defender, pushed him away from the ball. Ramos headed it in. It's what he does. He throws everything at it when he goes forward for every set piece. And he does, you know, he is aggressive. He's on the front foot, if you like. So he'll you know, make sure that he is physical. I thought it was a push. Didn't think it was offside, but... the goal, I thought, in the end was correctly disallowed, but for a foul, definitely weren't offside.
Yeah. So, Real Madrid at the top. I think Betis the second, aren't they? In fact, I'm certain they are.
Yes.
Even though we're obviously on the wrong number of games being played by various teams. So, Real Madrid top with 10 points from four games. As you say, just one game where they sort of slipped up. But it was away to Real Sociedad,
exactly.
Wasn't it?
So
it wasn't,
yeah.
It wasn't bad. Result. And Betis are weird, aren't they? I mean, Betis, you know, they sum up this weird season. You know, 2-0 win away to Valencia is a good result after having been poor in midweek.
Yeah, no, they were terrific. I mean, it's by and large this year Betis have been good. It was just that one game where it brought back memories of last season where they crumbled and we called them flaky. But again, at the weekend they were fantastic. I mean, it's. They were really, really good. We'll talk about Valencia in a moment, but from Betis' perspective, Joaquin was sensational. You know, I like the Sanabria up front. Needs a goal, of course, to improve his belief. But in general, I thought Guido Canales playing alongside Guido in midfield as opposed to Carvalho, who's been in good form but was poor against Getafe. And Canales was fantastic. Called up to the international squad. Well deserved after the career that he's had at the age of 29 to overcome all those injuries and setbacks. He's a lovely player to watch when he's playing well. So no, Betis were fantastic. I mean, there was no complaints from Pellegrini. There can't be, but from Valencia, I don't know where to start. I really don't. I mean, it was very few attempts on goal, very few touches for the front two. Maxi Gomez and Gamero never got into the game. Guedes continues to be a disappointment. There are players that you think shouldn't probably be playing for Valencia at the moment, but getting a game because of the lack of numbers in the squad and the lack of investment in the squad. And it just looks desperate at the moment. And there is talk they're going to sell one or two more.
Well, Condogbia, isn't it, today, apparently. So we'll see.
Without bringing anyone in.
Yeah,
and if it continues like this, there's no way possible that Valencia are going to push for a European spot. And if they continue playing like they did at the weekend, there's every chance we could be talking about relegation threatened Valencia. Because if you take away the name and the history of the club, and you purely look at the squad of players they have now, that's what they're going to be doing this year, battling for survival. Which is an incredible story. It really is. But when you look at them, you just think, well, they don't get any service to the front two. You know, Guedes has got to start playing better. Carlos Soler, back from injury at the weekend, came on for Condogbia, funny enough. So can he get back to the form that we saw? Let's be honest, with Guedes and Soler, pardon me, 2 or 3 years ago now. You know, you're looking at Guedes, he's 23. Carlos Soler's slightly younger, but... They've got to get those players back to form and you know, to give them any chance of being mid-table and maybe an outside push for a Europa League spot. But they're a long way from that at the moment. I find it really, really sad.
Let's crack on. Real Sociedad 3, Getafe 0. So again, a total reverse from the midweek results. Handball for the first one, the Athabal penalty, and then Mikel Merino had a terrific game, didn't he? So Porto got the third, lovely finish. How good a goal was that Mikel Merino one in the middle? He chests the ball twice, as the cross comes into the penalty area. Is he a bit lucky, or is it a brilliant goal?
No, I think because of the way he played, I think he's a really good player, capable of that stuff. So that's why I'll give him all the credit. And also in that game, I thought he was outstanding. And do you know why I thought he was outstanding? It was kind of like the beauty versus the beast, wasn't it? The style of Real Sociedad against the style of Getafe. I like both styles, love both styles. And he was the one player in the Real Sociedad team. If you look at them, they could you could accuse them of being a little bit lightweight, but really good to watch. They're a really good football team, but they can be a little bit lightweight. He's the one player, actually, that, particularly in midfield, that can impose himself on his opponents. So he was box to box. He was important defensively from the defensive set pieces. Every attacking set piece, it was him that was getting on it on the end of the crosses. And for I thought he was a fantastic performance from him. Great performance from Real Sociedad, but I thought he was the standout player because he was the one player that could physically match up with Getafe or at least try to match up. And, you know, he's the battle in midfield with Aaron Bari and Maximovic, with Marino and Silva was interesting to watch. Silva and Marino came out on top. The extra player helped with Zubimendi playing and making it a three. But, no, Real Sociedad were terrific. Mikel Merino was wonderful.
And did Bordalas have a case that in some way Real Sociedad were spoiling the game?
No. What, by keeping the ball and playing? No, not at all. Out of interest, I don't know if any of our podcast listeners, why did Mikel Merino not work out at Newcastle?
I don't know.
It's a really weird one because I heard about him at Osasuna when they got promotion and they sold him in the January prior to getting promotion to Dortmund. So, and then they kind of regretted it because you remember they came up and they were hopeless and they'd sold their best player, Mikel Merino, to Dortmund. Eventually ends up at Newcastle and he ends up back at Real Sociedad. And he's still only 24 now. And he's been at Real Sociedad a couple of years. And I've always wondered what happened there that Newcastle had this really talented player and somehow it didn't work out. He's ended up, thankfully, back in La Liga and thankfully for Real Sociedad performing week in, week out. He's a terrific player.
Yeah. Well, let's put that one out. If anyone knows the answer, if anyone watches Newcastle regularly, I mean, I've seen bits of them, but no, I didn't watch them regularly when he was there, so I don't know. Let's go Barcelona-Sevilla, shall we? But a big game of the weekend and a good game, Terry, as well. Early goals, and then after that, that was it. So Luc de Jong with one. It was following a corner, wasn't it? And he sort of banged it in from close range. And then Coutinho got the equaliser. And what was encouraging for me, when it was the old ball, wasn't it? Messi looking for Jordi Alba, didn't quite get to him. But there were four Barcelona players sprinting to get into the penalty area, which I think is, you know, where the goal essentially came from.
Yeah, no, I thought, I was slightly disappointed with the game. I think we had the early action, and then it kind of ended up in a stalemate. And then towards the last 10 minutes of the game, it opened up a little bit. Sevilla put on an extra striker. And Barcelona had one or two moments. Trincao had an opportunity, which was well saved by Bono. But I thought there was a period in the game, either side of half-time, where they sort of cancelled each other out. And neither wanted to risk too much at that stage to go on and get the win. So I was slightly disappointed from that perspective. But in terms of, it was a competitive game, it was a high quality game. I thought there was mistakes made from Barcelona that were sort of drifted back towards what we saw at the end of last season. I thought they gave away possession far too cheaply. I praised them the other night for, making sure they were tidying that up. But De Jong was, in particular, was Frankie De Jong, because there was two in this game, was in particular, really untidy in the first half. And I think that's something he has to eradicate because he always wants the ball. He wants the ball under pressure as well. But his passing was far too casual. So that kind of interrupted the flow of Barcelona's performance. But I thought in terms of Sevilla, it gives them solid belief, doesn't it, that they can go on this great, incredible run of form. And it gives them, it just reinforces that belief that maybe they can remain near the top of the table. And I'm not talking about near like they were in fourth position last year with 70 points. I'm talking about challenging, you know, for the title. Because the defeats they've had in the last few months have been few and far between.
Well, they've lost. I think it's February. They lost to Celta Vigo and haven't lost a game other than the Super Cup in extra time against Bayern Munich since then. So, given that we're talking about everything being weird, given that we don't have a classic Real Madrid or Barcelona at the moment, how genuine a possibility is it that Sevilla could actually win La Liga?
If they believe, and I firmly think that they are getting to that stage now, because they've had a good run in La Liga, and then they've beaten Wolves, Inter Milan, Manchester United. They're now competing with Barcelona away from home, and that result, you know, could have gone either way. It really could have gone either way. So if they start to believe, which I think they must be doing by now, you know, and a lot of new players last season, and you get that togetherness that come, that happens when you have success. I've seen the videos of the celebrations after winning the Europa League. There's a togetherness about the players now. Not too many changes in this transfer window so far. They're buying what they need. So the squad is deep enough. They're well coached, well drilled, hard to beat. They've got a player now in Luke de Jong who does look like he could be the player that gets the goals for Sevilla. The way they play, they're not going to need 3, 4, 5 goals a game to win matches. So, yeah, I said it before the season started, and I just think even more now that I'm not predicting they're going to win it, but they're going to come a lot closer. And if Barcelona, Real Madrid, Atletico Madrid are not at their best, then Sevilla could take advantage, no doubt whatsoever.
And Atletico, 0-0 against Villarreal. And, well, I mean, what a contrast, isn't it? You know, we're talking about 6 goals. Well, just a week ago. It's weird, isn't it? It seems like time's gone weird, isn't it? Because since then, they've had 2 goalless draws.
Yeah, and there's a lot of faults. And I think Simeone's got some big decisions to make. Their play is too predictable, too slow. And yeah, there are certain players in the team that are responsible for that. And I hate to say it because I've always been a big admirer, but Koke, I think, is the main one that's right, responsible. When Atletico, just quickly, when Atletico turn over possession and they win the ball back, if the ball goes into Koke, it's like he stops it and allows a team to get back in position. Then he starts the attack.
Yeah.
You kind of know
why?
What I mean. And he's,
why?
I don't know. I really don't know. His stats, and I don't want to be too critical because he has been a fabulous player, but I think he was best when he played wide in midfield, and that incredible work rate he had when they won the title was perfect for that position. You know, it was Turenne on the other side. On Koke, you had this player that was relentless in terms of work rate. But now he's gone in midfield, he's becoming like an organiser, and he slows it down. And his passing stats will be off the scale, honestly, because I think he actually got substituted at the weekend after 70 minutes for Carrasco. But his passing stats will be off the scale. Every pass is safe, but he stops it, he slows it down, he lets his teammates get in position, but at the same time, the opposition are getting back in position. And then he'll start playing it square, he plays it backwards, and everybody's in place. And that is so hard for any team to break down an opponent that's well organised. And in Villarreal, they were. Huesca, they were organised. They were happy to sit deep. So somehow Simeone's got to get his team playing more quicker attacking football. Because what you see is they take so long, it's so precise, it's predictable, that teams get back in position quickly, and then it's the attack versus defence, and the defence are packed out in numbers, and Atletico are finding it hard to make a breakthrough. Slightly frustrating that he takes Suarez off for Costa. I think that's going to cause problems. Suarez isn't going to take kindly to... Might be okay at this moment in time, although it didn't look it when Suarez came off, because he's only just joined the club. They've got, you know, hasn't had the pre-season with them and whatever. But I tell you now, if he takes Suarez off every game for Costa, Suarez is going to get the ump. Particularly if they're not winning games. Suarez had the ump at the weekend because it was 0-0. He gets taken off with 20 minutes to go. He still believes he can make his team a goal, that they can win the game. So when he got brought off, you could see the frustration there. again, it's similar to Huesca. They you know, if they were going to, they tried everything to go through Villarreal. It wasn't working. You know, take off Suarez. Why not leave him on with Costa? You know, and get the ball in the box to, you know, two physical strikers that might make something happen. So it's frustrating. It's so safe and predictable from Atletico that it makes quite easy for teams like Villarreal with the quality they have to defend against.
Right, I've been so enjoying our chat, Terry. I've forgotten to have an ad break, so we are supposed to do that. So let's have a quick break, and we'll come back with the rest of the games from the weekend in La Liga. Welcome back. Those adverts don't make us a lot of money, by the way, which is why we've got the Patreon page. So, frankly, we'd like you to join in the Patreon. But we're going to carry on podcasting anyway, because, you know, because we want to, and because we want new people to come and listen and get into La Liga and hopefully enjoy the service that we provide here. But if you do want to join in the Patreon, there's going to be new Patreon stuff going up as well. But it's patreon.com. And you go /LTEL, that's the name of it, and it's La Liga Weekly, and you make your contribution that way, and that would be much appreciated. Thank you. Now, you were talking about your frustrations with Atletico, Terry, that they do everything too slowly. I think that brings us to Athletic, doesn't it? Beaten 1-0 by Alaves, so terrific result for Alaves. We should give them credit, but worrying times for Athletic.
Oh, it's going to be a really interesting couple of weeks. I mean, there's not the possibility of them making loads of signings to improve the squad. I think the manager is really under pressure to lose four consecutive home games and then go to Alaves at the weekend, where he didn't make too many changes to the starting lineup. And the lack of attacking flair in the team is remarkable, you know. And it's I don't see a plan. It's too slow. For the first 15, 20 minutes of the game, they were quite lively and looked the more likely of the two teams to win. And then it just faded away. We saw good movement in the opening 15, 20 minutes. We saw the pace of Iñaki Williams. We saw Ihan Sancek receiving the ball in dangerous positions. But that was how long it lasted, 15 minutes. And they were playing a team that had no idea what they were doing. So my big criticism of Athletic this week is that they had a team on the ropes. They had no idea what system they were playing. I could see what they were trying to do, but it wasn't working. And they were there for the taking. And how Athletic got beat. I know why they got beat, because Alaves brought on Lucas Perez. That simple. He was the one player of any quality in that game. It was a terribly disappointing game. And he completely changed it. So he stood out like a beacon in terms of one player coming on and making a difference at halftime. No idea why he wasn't starting, but he was the big difference in the game. By the end of it, Athletic did deserve to win. Second half was better from Alaves, Rodrigo Eli getting the goal, and from Lucas Perez free kick. So I think I look at Garitano, he keeps changing the front players. You're not sure. Surely the obvious one would be, because of the goals he scored last year playing as a centre forward, to play Raul Garcia there. But he's playing Raul Garcia wide on the right, and he doesn't look at home now. You might get away with Raul Garcia playing as the second striker. He's a player that needs to be in the thick of the action. He's a protagonist. He upsets people. He gets on people's nerves. But he got the goals last year playing in either the centre-forward position or the second striker position. He's playing him wide on the right. That's not a position he can fulfil anymore. Iñaki Williams has been better on the right than he has at centre-forward. He's playing centre-forward at the moment. Meunier and Williams have to deliver. You know, they're big stars of Athletic Club. You know, and you know, there's been talk over the years, loads of times, of, you know, clubs in Europe, Premier League, wanting these two players, the buyout clauses and stuff. And you look at those two players now, I look at them and I think that they're actually doing well to be in the team at the moment, at Athletic Club. So they need to stand up and be counted. Meunier didn't start the weekend. He was on the bench. Iñaki Williams was brought off again. So they need their big players. The Athletic supporters, I know there's none in the stadium at the moment, but they deserve far better. It's a decent squad, some good players. Kappa is unrecognisable now, fullback. He used to be, last season, such a threat going forward. a real powerhouse. Now you barely see him cross the halfway line. The same with Yuri Bacici. In about 10 minutes where he, at the beginning of the game, where he pushed on. That was it. So big issues at Athletic Club. They need to be doing far better. They shouldn't be second bottom in the league. I know it's a disjointed league table, but they shouldn't be down that far. They should be a lot higher up.
Better results not far away then for Osasuna, 2-0 against Celta Vigo. Facundo, now, I think it's Spain saying Roncaglia, don't they say the G? I don't think they do in Italy, though. But he's not Italian, so who knows? I don't. So he scored anyway. And my issue with his, he didn't celebrate because he was a former Celta Vigo player. There are no fans in the stadium. So... Tell him, it's scored a brilliant goal. Celebrate it.
Oh, brilliant goal. I mean, there was not a lot between these two teams, I have to be honest, but that goal came completely changed the game because Osasuna know how to defend the lead. And, you know, for him to score the goal in the way that he did, it's a brilliant strike. He had far too much time. Again, I talked about, you know, Alaves not knowing I should have explained, Alaves were playing a three at the back, with wing-backs, but one wing-back was playing as winger right high up the pitch. The other wing-back was playing as a left-back. So at times you thought, is it a four? Then it was a five. And Perry Pons in midfield had no one ahead of him or to the side of him on the left of the midfield three. So he ended up playing left-back and left-wing and left-midfield. It was carnage. And kind of with Celta Vigo, that's exactly the same is happening there. Every single game, he changes the system. So Osasuna didn't have a lot to beat. Once they get ahead with that fantastic goal from Roncaglia, we call him Facundo. It was a brilliant strike, and he is capable of that. We've seen it, not very often, but we have seen it before from him. They know how to defend the lead. They're solid, they're hard to break down, they're direct. They have players that work their socks off up front, and then they get the second goal in the later stages of the game. So Osasuna, that's what they do. You know, they're well coached, well organised. They know what they're doing. 4-4-2 system, they know how they're playing. Inigo Perez played left-back. I haven't seen him play there for a while. He played left-back and knew exactly his job. I looked at Celta, they didn't have a clue what they're doing. And that's the thing for me this weekend, it might be the title, is the chaos that some coaches provide at their clubs. Alaves, Athletic Club, Celta Vigo. Celta Vigo played 4-3-3 against Eibar and Emre Moore played wide and was terrific. So the next game he played 4-4-2 with Emre Moore as a centre-forward. Took him off. His form was dissipated. He's now not starting games. They played against Valladolid with 4-4-2. Then they played 4-5-1 against Barcelona. And at the weekend, they played 4-1-4-1. And that's five games, four different systems of play. And don't even ask me how many times he changes during a game. So I tell you what happens then, John, and people listening. The players will look and go, he hasn't got a clue what he's doing. Not a clue. He'll lose the players.
Tactical genius, that, Terry.
Exactly, yeah. He'll lose the players. And they'll go, they'll make jokes of it. Played under managers that have done it, not so much in the past because there wasn't that many systems to play, but there were different intricacies that managers wanted to do. And if they tried too many and it wasn't working, then you know they're searching for something. There's no patience from the manager in terms of a style of a system of play. There's little time this week to have worked between the three games they played 4-4-2 against Valladolid, and then midweek they played 4-5-1 against Barcelona. And at the weekend, 4-1-4-1. So in the space of 8 days, he's had to work on three different systems of play in the few training sessions that they had between matches. And it looks it. And then during the game, he'll change to 4-4-2, 4-3-3, three at the back. It's incredible. So my advice to any of these coaches that are sudden about with different systems every single game and changing them during the match, just calm down, be patient. It's early in the season. Give everyone a chance to flourish in a system of play, in a position that suits them. So as I said, Emery Moore was fantastic in the first game, man of the match against Eibar. We hadn't seen him for ages. We always knew he was a talent that needed harnessing. And then since then, he's not played in that position again. So please, managers, calm down.
Yeah, right then. Valladolid 1, Eibar 2. So Valladolid, generally we regard as a well-coached team, don't we? But struggle with results this season. Obviously,